Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler and I'm your host today. Today we have a very interesting guest, someone I met on LinkedIn. His name is Steve Haberlin, and we are exploring the questions that are kind of quietly shaping the future of contemplative practice. And that is, what happens when meditation meets artificial intelligence? I know it's scary. For some of us, we just get a little shiver down our back and we want to like close down. But I ask you to stay open to this conversation if you're capable, because over the last decade or two, contemplative apps have become part of the daily routines of many, many people. These apps have made meditation more accessible, more portable. And it just means more people are participating in meditation and yoga and mindfulness. So on one hand, we're reaching more people, but on the other hand, are we doing it responsibly? Are we doing it ethically? Are we outsourcing our own jobs to AI? And, you know, those are really hard questions, but it is here and we have to ask ourselves these questions. Some people feel very encouraged by AI. Other people feel like, no, I don't want anything to do with it. It's ruining the earth. It's, you know, using too many water resources. And I don't actually want to engage with it. And I always say to people, if 20 years ago we had decided we did not want to use the internet, that's kind of where we're at today. It's going to be one of those things that if you choose to kind of bow out of society and not be on the internet, that's a wonderful choice. And artificial intelligence is kind of, you know, we're at that moment where you get to decide if you're going to opt in, opt out, or maybe get a few years behind and then figure out, oh my gosh, I guess there's no way around this. If I want to be part of society, I may have to engage with this. And others may say, you know what? I'm retiring. I'm done. I don't even want to go there. So these are all really hard questions that we have to ask ourselves. And today I'm going to talk to Steve about how do we use it ethically? How do we keep our use of AI human-centered? And I know that sounds like a strange thing. Wait a minute. How could AI be human-centered? Or sometimes in yoga therapy, we say client-centered, but I think you'll appreciate Steve's response to that. After his decades of deep, deep meditation practice, he really is grounded in this human experience and also seeing what's coming at us really, really quickly. So let's go meet Steve, and I hope you can breathe through some of the difficult parts of this interview. If they're creating anxiety for you, you can turn it off and go for a walk and maybe come back later. But if you're capable of not shutting down, because that's the feeling I get in my body, like, I'm hyperventilating. You know, let's see if we can stay with it, stay present, and really digest it and see what comes up. All right. Let's go talk to Steve. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 10. We are headed into the springtime of 2026. We have a spring in our step. We hope you do too. So let's go meet our guest. Let's go get started. Welcome, Steve. We're so happy to have you today. Thanks for being here.
Oh, honored to be here. Thanks.
Steve, I always like to tell our listeners where each of us is in the world so they can kind of ground into our conversation. So where are you located?
I am out a little bit outside of Tampa, kind of between Tampa and Orlando, Florida, where the temperature is, people are not going to like this, but it's all up to about 80 again. So it's really nice right now before the humidity sets in.
And we're recording this in the middle of February, just so you know, if you're listening to this later. So that's pretty warm. Well, I'm in Minnesota and we've come out of the cold stretch. We're probably around 40 every day, which feels good to me. I consider myself kind of a hiking woman and I don't like it too hot.
Right.
So, well, Steve, thanks for coming on the show. Just a little background. I have this little book that I write down interesting people in my little book. Like if I'm in going through LinkedIn, I'm like, oh, that person. And then sometimes it just happens that we get to know each other. So I think I commented on one of your posts. I was looking back at our little chain on LinkedIn. And then you said thank you. And, you know, over a series of exchange messages, I invited you to the podcast. So it's amazing how you can just meet people on LinkedIn and start to form friendships and professional relationships. So the thing
it is, you had reposted one of my posts or something on AI and mindfulness. And then when I reached out to you, you were like, yeah, these are spot on. It's very interesting. We started talking. But you know, what's fascinating is, not to get sidetracked, but with kind of social networking and the technology today, we might have never met, and we do similar type work, right? And have a lot of things in common, but we might have never met at a conference or something like that. And then, it's pretty cool how you can just connect.
I love that about the algorithms. It's actually showing me almost all the people that are doing things in this very narrow little area that you and I are so interested in. So we're talking today about kind of like contemplative sciences, maybe meditation, in my case, yoga therapy, and AI, and kind of what is the future of AI. And I think the post that you were posting on LinkedIn had to do with a customized GPT kind of chat bot that you had created. And I was like, whoa. So can you tell us a little bit about these kind of chat bots that are kind of tailored mindfulness guides, if you will?
Yeah, I can even show an example in a minute. But so the chatbots are based, so they're LLMs, large language models, right? Which some people might be familiar, and other people are just kind of using them as a search engine. So, you know, when these come out, like with OpenAI, with ChatGPT, I started thinking about, well, how could these be used for meditation and mindfulness practice and maybe delivery or guidance or coaching, but beyond like creating a script, because they can create a script. So let's say you say, create a breath awareness meditation for me that's, you know, maybe 3 minutes long for beginners. It'll do that. It'll create a script and it'll draw upon all of the data out there on different traditions and mindfulness, and it'll create that script. But I want to go a step further. I was like, well, what if you start using this for live facilitation? So just to back up a little bit for the audience, in my classes for years, I've been starting every single class. I don't start a class without doing a brief mindfulness or breath work or meditation moment. And it just takes like a couple minutes. And we've studied this with undergrads, but right now I work with doctoral students at University of Central Florida, and we're doing an actual study. We're collecting data on their perceptions of this, but I wanted to start with a GPT, like could it deliver the mindfulness effectively, at least at the same level that I would do it with the students? And how do the students respond to this? You know, is it freak them out? Is it comfortable? Do they find that they sustain the practice because of this? So a customized GPT is just a personalized GPT. You have to have the upgraded version, the paid version, and you can go on. We could even I did a workshop with the steps to how to create a personalized GPT for meditation. We can put the link, and it's a free workshop. They could follow that because it would take a little time to unpack it. But essentially, a customized GPT is where it has a personalized kind of focus or mission. So you can create one basically for anything. So I took it and I created a meditation coach. I call it Meta Zen, which is kind of meta beyond, like, which is part from title of my new book, but Zen, you know, we all know Zen being calm. And Meta Zen, when I designed it, you can give it a personality and you can upload data to it and a name and a picture. And I wanted it to have kind of a contemplative but science-based approach. So it's grounded in the neuroscience. It's kind of a no-nonsense kind of guide and just can do whatever practice you want to do. So we can try one if...
Yeah, start that's okay. Off, like one of
so
your.
I'll show you what I'll do in class with the students. So, okay, Metazen, are you there?
I'm right here with you. Whenever you're ready, we can explore your meditation journey together. What's on your mind today?
Can you lead us through a brief mindfulness practice, maybe just a minute or two, the way we do with the doctoral students in class this semester?
Absolutely. Let's keep it brief but effective. Go ahead and settle into a relaxed but alert posture, feet grounded, spine tall. Gently rest your hands. Now close or soften your eyes if comfortable. Take a slow, deep breath in through your nose and exhale gently out through your mouth. Now let's anchor attention on the feeling of the breath at the nostrils. Notice the coolness as you inhale, the warmth as you exhale. If the mind drifts, no judgment. Just gently return to the sensation of breath. Let's stay with a few quiet breaths. Now take one more deep breath in and let it go. Gently open your eyes. That's it. Just a minute of anchoring presence. How did that feel?
Can you tell us a little bit about the tradition behind that? Where does this come from?
The simple act of anchoring your attention on the breath is rooted in mindfulness practices, most famously from the Buddhist tradition, but now widely supported by modern research. In early teachings, like in the Satipatthana Sutta, it was a foundational technique for cultivating presence and insight. Neuroscience now backs it. Focusing on breath can regulate attention networks and calm the nervous system. So when we sit with the breath, we're blending ancient wisdom with modern brain science.
And could you give one tip for listeners about how they might incorporate this into their daily routine or sustain it over time?
One practical tip: attach this mindful breath check to a daily habit you already do, like brushing your teeth or sitting down at your desk. Each time, pause for 60 seconds and focus on the breath. By linking it to something consistent, it becomes a natural part of your day, like a micro reset. And over time, that consistency rewires your brain for more mindful living.
There you go. Even if you know the information as a teacher, I mean, I know that general information, but to deliver it that quickly and succinctly is right. We're not always capable of doing that. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is using it as a coaching tool. I'm also there with the students, in case it says something a little wonky or hallucinates, but it's generally spot on, It's pretty good. Like if you were to ask me, what's a tip for sustaining, I would definitely say link it to a behavior, to a routine, So like with me, it's like before I have my breakfast, I sit and I meditate. I won't have my breakfast until I do that. So, or in between your coffee or something, right? So that's a solid tip right there.
So, how do your students respond? You said you're doing some studies. Are they receptive to this? Do they like it? Do they not like it?
The short answer, I don't know yet, because we're probably in like week four. I think we're in week four or five of the study, and we've been collecting some qualitative data on their perceptions. They're doing these anonymous surveys, they're doing these electronic surveys, and then one of the graduate assistants I have on the team will do some focus groups. We'll do some interviewing, or what we call focus groups, with them in small groups. So I'm not sure yet. All I know is see their kind of faces on the screen, and they'll kind of laugh because last week it seemed very rushed, and I said, Medizin, are you stressed out today? Because you seem very in a rush or a hurry, And they'll kind of laugh at the interactions, but I don't know if they're thinking, like, I hate this, I love this. I can always follow up when we have some preliminary findings, but I don't know yet what they think.
I have a couple of thoughts. First of all, your students, let's say that their average age 17 to 24, they might be experiencing it quite differently than maybe a graduate student who might be closer to their 40s. I guess you said right now you're teaching graduate students. Or in my case, I'm teaching a lot of 40 and older students that have come back to school now. So I'm finding that the difference in the ages is really making a big difference as to whether they want to accept this type of thing or if they're like, no way, I hate this. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think the sample, I do think the demographics will affect it, like their context, even what professions they're coming from. I don't think there's enough. There's just haven't been studies done on this to compare, say, undergraduates' acceptability rates or engagement rates versus graduates. But yeah, that's something to look at. That's definitely something to consider. My theory would be with the younger generations might be more acceptable to anything. If you look at digital interventions, when you look at like smartphones or doing learning mindfulness from modules and videos, they generally have a higher level of acceptance because they're digital citizens, right? So it makes sense. But with AI, it's their views of AI are kind of all over the place. But a lot of younger people are using AI for mental wellness, for therapy and thing, which is a whole nother situation. And I have some mixed thoughts about that. But I don't know. That's a great question, whether they perceive it differently or they'd rather do that than a human, or I don't know.
So I want to go back to some of your history, Steve. You are a TM or were a TM practitioner. I don't know if that's still your form.
It's my basic meditation.
And just tell us a little bit about how long you've been doing TM, when you got initiated, just so people know where you're coming from.
Oh, sure. So about 30 years ago, so it goes all the way back. It was in the 90s. I was an undergrad student, pretty stressed out, and I learned TM is transcendental meditation. It was brought over in the late 50s. 50s and became popular in the United States in the 60s and 70s from the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, was the founder. He basically took a very ancient technique, which is mantra meditation. He took a sound or two syllable, and you actually do get initiated. You learn it directly from a teacher, and they still do it to this day. I learned directly from a teacher. They teach you how to use this sound in a certain way, and then that brings you down to a meditative state. And it's not like you're sleep. Your body feels very relaxed and rested, but you're very much awake. You're very aware. You'll hear even the smallest sound will sound really loud to you, or maybe traffic outside. It can become magnified because you're in such a settled state. So I learned that about 30 years ago. No, I still practice. I've tried and learned all different methods, and I do things with technology. That's like my foundation. That's my basis. I always come back to at least doing some of that each morning. Preferably, you do it twice. You do it also in the evening before dinner. But yeah, transcendental meditation had a lot of research back in the early days, 70s, 80s. And then mindfulness came in, and just, the mindfulness movement, I think, just took over. And a lot of the research went to like the mindfulness-based stress reduction and other types of interventions, which are wonderful. It's great. They show positive effects, but I think TM got drowned out by, the mindfulness movement. But it's still a very valid. A lot of celebrities, Jerry Seinfeld is a big TM practitioner. The Beatles had originally popularized it, and I think maybe, I don't know if any of them still practice that are alive. A lot of other celebrities practice, athletes, because it's a very simple technique, the mantra, and it only takes, maybe 15, 20 minutes a session, and then you'd get benefits. That's my traditional training.
I love that. So, what do you think would have happened? I had heard you tell the story before that you had gone to the teacher, you sat before them, you learned the sound, you, I think, went away for 10 days, tried it out, came back to the teacher to, basically see if you had any questions, how it was going for you, and make sure there's no adverse effects. What if that had been done as an AI teacher? Instead of literally sitting with another human, do you think you'd still be doing it today?
That's a great question. I don't know. I'd have to test that. But the structures you learn, it's like in a 4 day. It's only 4 days. You learn some of the background, the history of the technique, all that, and the benefits in the first few days with a live person, usually with maybe a couple other students that are learning in a living room or a center. And then you, on the final day, you come back and you go through this little process, and they give you the technique you practice. And then a very important part of it is checking. So you go to these checking, you set up a time a week or two later. You actually can do it with the TM organization. You can do it anytime for free. You go and you sit with the teacher, and they will review the technique with you, the method, and then you will practice in their presence, and then they will ask questions because they're trying to fill out your subjective experience and make sure you're doing it properly. You're on the right track. Back to the question, I don't know. It would be completely different. Like, it would not be the same because I had a great rapport with my teacher. Name was Marsha. I still email her once in a while. She still teaches, like, all these years later. She's been teaching like 40 years and doing it. Still email her, still have, much respect. And it was that the presence of the teacher, the relationship, being able to ask her questions, and she understood my situation as a young stressed out person at the time and my goals. I don't think that would be the same at all. I don't know if I would have continued if I learned on an app or AI. I think that would have probably be different. I've put forward what I call a human first mindfulness, AI mindfulness model. And I say human first because I think if you can learn from a person, an actual human, even if that's virtually, I really advocate that. And the research backs that. It shows you can, predictors of persisting or sticking with meditation or mindfulness is linked to having this positive experience with an actual person or a group of people, like in a retreat or something, a workshop. So I recommend first with a person, but I think the AI has incredible potential to support that instruction. Okay, so I learned from the teacher on that last day, and then I had a week or two before I went back to them. That's the opportunity gap right there. I think that's the gold right there, is we could say, could AI be trained or informed by this teacher or this group to say, okay, now I want this person to use the AI, the meditation teacher, the chatbot to support the training until they come back to me or until I reconnect with them so that if they have questions or they forget the technique, they can be guided. So it's not replacing the meditation teacher, it's supplementing or enhancing. I think the way that we frame it is so, so important. So that's where I see the opportunity is like in the interim and as an extension, what the teacher can do.
It could help. This kind of what we're calling a blended model could help to support and complement the human experience and help with adherence or compliance. Because if we can get kind of into a habit in the first 40 days, the chances of us staying with that meditation are probably much better. And so that, like you said, that opportunity gap is so critical.
Let's take just a little pause and talk about something that's really exciting. There's a new book coming out in spring 2026 called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. It's authored by Amy Wheeler, myself, and Marlisa Sullivan. We've been working really hard on this book for about 18 months, and now it's scheduled for release in spring 2026. This text will bring together philosophical foundations of yoga, emerging research in neuroscience, and evidence-informed methods for applying these teachings in clinical and community settings. The book is designed for healthcare providers, yoga teachers, yoga therapists, educators, and really anyone seeking to clearly understand the why of why yoga works and the how, the mechanism underneath why yoga works. Your purchase of this book will help to advance the field of yoga therapy, and it will support the continued development of resources like this podcast, the Yoga Therapy Hour. And we hope it will serve both you and your clients alike. So please keep an eye out for Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan coming out through Routledge Press in 2026. All right, let's get back to the episode.
I like the blended, by the way, blended hybrid. Yeah, that's a great way. Blended model rather than, because I think when people look at it, they go, oh, it's like a one or the other. Or meditation teachers out there, yoga teachers out there, you think, oh, it's going to replace me, you know, or take my teaching job, or they're not going to need me anymore. I don't think that's the case at all. I think if you look at it as a blended model or as a co-pilot companion, then it's a support and it can extend further. It can strengthen what you already do. I don't think it's going to replace you.
I'm having two thoughts in my mind. I'm having the thought of Marsha and how decades later, you're still having this positive association with Marsha and sometimes emailing her. But then I'm also thinking about some of the new research that's showing as people interact with chatbots, they're saying they feel less judged. To say things that they maybe wouldn't want to say to a therapist or somebody that might think badly of them. And I put that in air quotes. So do you have any thoughts on that? This idea of human connection versus some people are actually not as comfortable with that deep human connection. And it's safer for them at that moment in their life to talk to a large language model, which first, I think we should just acknowledge, like, the large language model is not having any feelings towards you.
Yeah.
It doesn't even understand what you're saying. It's just putting words one after another. So could you explain that first?
There's a lot of, I think there's currently a lot of issues, and probably therapists, counselors out there would agree. Like, LLMs were not designed for therapy. They were not designed for mental wellness. And there's some statistics show like 40-50% of the usage sometimes is for mental health or wellness. That's a problem because they weren't designed. I think in the future, they will be more specialized towards that. But that's not the original use. So you're using something and making it kind of conform to your needs and your goals. So that's a problem there. And then some of the other problems with the chatbots that they found is they're not human and they don't always pick up on red flags of suicide ideation, you know, just real at-risk behaviors. And they can be very agreeable with you. They can hallucinate. There is a chance they could give really bad advice or tell you things that they should not be telling you. So I think there's that gray area right now that makes me very hesitant to say these. You should go out and, you know, use a chatbot for wellness, even some of these that are being designed for that. I think that the research has to bear out. I think we have to have more data on that and we have to get better at that. But then even when it is designed for wellness, like a chatbot, I still think the human needs to stay in the loop. And I know there's benefits like accessibility with a wellness chatbot is, you got 24/7 access, you got privacy, you might not feel judged because maybe a young person doesn't want to talk to human at that moment, and they're talking. But I think the human, just like the meditation, the mindfulness loop, I'm saying human first, human stays in the entire loop. I think that same model would make sense carrying over. And, I'm not a therapist, but it seems like that model would carry over into the mental wellness realm where the human stays in the loop is a much safer, ethical way to do it than to let people go off and just talk to artificial intelligence as a therapist. I think that's dangerous territory.
I agree with you. And it's interesting because more people say they started with a customized chat GPT like you've created are getting introduced to mindfulness meditation or TM meditation or you name it that otherwise wouldn't have access to that, wouldn't go find a teacher, maybe couldn't afford a teacher. I mean, on some level, it actually might improve the chances of yoga teachers, yoga therapists, meditation teachers, all of us actually getting more people introduced to these techniques. So potentially that would come back to creating more work and more opportunity to connect because more people are in the funnel, if you will.
Yeah, that's a great point, but I think there's two parts to it. There's accessibility and the exposure, the introduction, and then there's the actual practice and sustainability of that, right? Of that mechanism. So there was a great article about that with smartphone meditation apps on smartphones where, years ago, even in the 80s, 90s, maybe a couple hundred thousand people might have been exposed to meditation and mindfulness through workshops and training and TM and those kind of things. But now it's millions, right? Within that same frame of time is millions or even a billion or something could be exposed. The problem is most of the smart apps, like the meditation apps, people quit. The statistics are that like 90 something percent don't make it past the first 30 days. And then the research also shows that the dosage appears to be less. So they might just be doing 5 minutes or whatever, 10 minutes. But compared to traditional meditators and those who have been practicing a long time, like before the apps, they're meditating for longer sustained periods of time. So not only are they maybe not sticking with it, but even when they're doing it, it might not be enough. It might not be enough of a dosage, right, to really gain the benefits in their life mentally and physically. So I think the bottom line is, yes, we continue to expand accessibility, but we have to dial it in. We have to get better at figuring out not only how to introduce it to people digitally or through technology, but then instruct them in the right, in the best ways, and then keep them on the path, help them to sustain a habit. So I think technology helped the first part one, but I don't think we have part two down yet if you look at the statistics.
Do you have any ideas about part two, just from your experience?
I do. I think there's a few things that might help part two. Meditation app companies, the big players around to this. One is community. It's not a isolated kind of activity. It is an isolated activity, but especially when you're first learning, if you could be around others and connected with like a community of practitioners. So, having virtual gatherings or meetups or things like that as you're learning, be able to connect with other meditators is a good practice. I don't think that in itself might get people to continue practice, but personalization, using AI to further personalize and provide additional layers of support. That's where these companies are starting to try now, like Ebb, which is a mental wellness kind of chatbot, but it works as a companion to what they're already doing. So they're having these interactive AI bots where they're collecting your data, like how long you practice, what you prefer, what style, what music, and then it can make future recommendations and try to dial. It's always about dialing in your practice and further personalize it. So I think you're seeing AI now is like, hey, wait a minute. This is a very advanced technology that we can bring into these older models and add more layers of support. Because remember, the older models, like a smartphone app originally was just guided meditation videos. And you watch a few, but that doesn't necessarily provide enough personalization. So yeah, I think that's what they're testing, and that's the way to go is to use the AI in ethical ways where it supports the instruction and kind of keeps you on the right track.
Yeah. Do you think this is going to move into like you can see a hologram and actually talk to someone, you know, like beyond text to voice?
We already have that. There's already that. If you look at Trip, are you familiar with the Trip app? So they have the Meta Quest. These are the 3D virtual reality headsets. So Trip is an app. It's a mindfulness meditation type app that you put on. So you're in a virtual 3D environment, right? You're totally immersed in this virtually created environment. And they have a feature called Kakua. They have an AI avatar that appears before you and you can speak to it in real time. And you could say, I'm really stressed out today. You know, I just went to a family gathering or Thanksgiving and my family's driving me crazy. What can I do? And it will talk you, it'll say, okay, and let's do some breath work for that. And then I'll say, well, how are you feeling now? And it's limited to some extent. I've experimented with it, but it's what you're talking about. It's essentially a hologram that's talking to you in real time and trying to personalize your meditation practice. So yeah, that's not far. And I think there's going to be more advanced versions of those kind of things coming out. Oh, and then the glasses, Amy, the smart glasses, because I posted on that because I saw on the Super Bowl commercials, they're marketing it right now, like the AI glasses to athletes and for doing, you know, movement and different things. It's just a matter of time where someone gets that and then they're able to interact with an AI, maybe see a beautiful landscape. You're in a Zen garden or forest and it will guide you through and even collect data and just, you know, guide you in this kind of sci-fi way. I think the glasses is probably the next thing that's going to come out.
Does it freak you out at all? Or is this just part of your everyday?
I don't know. I think you just have to adapt and it's hard. Maybe it's harder for some people. I think it's exciting. I think it's great stuff. The smartphone and social media and all that really changed the way we live. And it had definitely had disadvantages and there's harmful things and there's a lot of strengths. And I think AI is the same thing. These are all just tools. I just find it really interesting and kind of exciting if we look at it as a tool and we say, well, how can this further enhance what we're doing? But no, this is the way society's moving. You know, everything is going to be immediately connected. You know, educate every area of life, education, mental health, medical is going to be where the resistance. A lot of the resistance is removed between what you want to learn or do. Usually it takes steps and time and resources, but people are just going to have less and less resistance and more access, which is exciting, but it is scary because, you know, people are going to use it well and this is going to create more problems, fewer problems.
And also privacy.
Privacy, right?
They are tapping into our biometrics or
yes.
We will be able to. Our thoughts, our emotions, our reactions. I mean, you know, worst case scenario, they're mapping our brains.
Yeah.
And that can be used in a harmful way. So what do we need to do to, or can we even protect ourselves from this harvest?
Yeah.
Exactly. They're going to know us better than we're going to know ourselves.
Yeah, that's definitely a downside. That's a big safeguard. That's a cautionary safeguard that we need to navigate, get our hands around, and try to make sure that they're going to collect the data. There's no way around that. So when I use this, they're already doing that. The meditation apps already do that. When I use this and I do Trip, it's already collecting some kind of usage data. You know, depending on the wearable or what you're using, it's already collecting biometrics. The problem is this has already happened. There were some instances where it looked like some mental wellness apps have been accused of selling the private data, sharing it with other companies and others, you know, those kind of things. And the initial problem was it fell between, it was a loophole with HIPAA. It didn't fall under HIPAA. The federal government got involved and tried to tighten that and strengthen that up. And I do think there has to be more oversight on what happens to the data. And there has to be consequences if the data is sold or managed or used, because people are entrusting the company or the host or whoever you're sharing it with. But you can make the same argument with AI. If you use ChatGPT today, it knows all about you and it has a memory, so to speak. So it continues to collect that. So that's a much bigger issue, I think, than just mindfulness practice. I don't really have, in all honesty, Amy, I don't have all the answers. It has to be between the whoever's using it, teaching it, the government, there have to be safeguards. There have to be things put into place to know that that data is only going to stay in whatever it is, your personal cloud, and not be shared. It's almost like when you talk to a counselor or something, they take that oath, and the problem is this is not a counselor, and it's not,
Corporation.
it's who is this that's collecting our data, right?
One thing that we did, we have meditation slash yoga app, and we stripped out all the identifying data and just said, put any email in here, make up an email if you want, just to kind of assure people that we're not collecting it, we're not running stats on it, that kind of thing. And then we say on there, we're not using your data, that type of thing. But it's really been kind of a hindrance for people because they are hesitant to put in how they're feeling multiple times a day.
Yeah, I don't know. Because part of the problem is if you want, say, like the AI to use the data to predict your future session or future personalized, then it needs to house that. It needs to collect that data as it goes because it's using that. So if you don't put it in, it can't further personalize. But if you do put it in, you're giving up very personal information. So it's a catch 22. I don't know.
Like I said, the little bit I've used chatbots, I try to disguise myself if I'm using it for any kind of counsel. I say, like, I have a client who,
I know a friend. I have a friend at work who.
good friend at work, but it does sometimes show us things. Like I said, it's almost like it knows us better than we know ourselves. Like, of course, I should have been able to see that, but I'm in here, so I can't see out there, almost like a counselor, right? That they can see things about you that you can't see. So that's kind of shocking too when you get that feedback of, whoa, is that what this means? I had no idea. Or is
Yeah, it can serve as a mirror. It's a technological mirror. It's not always an accurate mirror. It's not always the best reflection. That mirror is getting clearer. That mirror is getting better and better, each day, each week, each month. And it can serve as a mirror where if you don't have access to a friend who can give you the feedback or, your boss will give you the feedback, it can be a feedback mechanism that you have constant access to. And whether that's for mindfulness or for your own work and you're trying to get that regular feedback, that is a game changer. That's a huge change in the way that we go about our day.
yeah. One of my last questions before we start talking about your book and all that you have going on, what do you think this means as a college professor? So am I, like, what does this mean for education beyond, mindfulness apps, but this whole AI revolution are going to be needed? What are our roles going to look like going
I've really thought about that a lot. I've listened to many people talk about that. I've
stop?
asked people. Yeah, because, we're all concerned. I think it's the same theme. It's greater personalization, or what I call what mindfulness, hyper personalization. So I think what it means in higher ed and schools, and especially higher ed, it's going to be personalizing the learning. So working as like an AI agent is you're going to have your own tutor, essentially. You can tell it what you want to learn. And it's going to give you that in a million different formats. Visual can create podcasts. It's already doing that. We're already using that, right, for our students. It's going to continue, I think, to move in super personalization for students. Now, are we still needed? I think so, because who's guiding that personalization, right? And who's knowing if that's off or, for example, I teach basic research methods to doctoral students. If it starts giving information that's incorrect about how to set up the design of a study or the ethical ramifications of a study or something, there has to be someone who has that level of experience, who's the expert, so to speak, that can step in and say, well, wait a minute, this is not correct. There has to be oversight on that. So I think, well, our expertise, the good news is, we'll still always be needed as the expert. We'll just not be doing so much as giving feedback, and the instruction will be a little bit, enhanced or off or out of our hands and that kind of thing. As far as our own jobs, I think I asked my department chair about this, and he's an instructional technology expert, scholar. And I agreed with his answer. He said, it's not going to necessarily replace us. It will automate some of our thing, our duties as a professor in education, like grading and those kind of things. What's going to happen is going to create a condition where we're going to be expected to be even more productive, much more productive. Because the argument's going to be that, well, now it can take care of your grading, give student feedback and all that. So now you should be applying for even more grants. You should be doing more research pay, more writing, because you have all these, right, AI agents and helpers, so to speak, campaign. So now you should be able to really magnify your impact and your work. And I think that's what we're going to be pressured to do is just do much, much more because we have new tools. That's my prediction is we're not going to be gone. They might need fewer people, but those fewer people are going to be expected to produce much more.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the way I'm choosing to think of it is a lot of monotonous tasks. You know, it used to take me 2 hours to create a nice PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Now, as you and I were playing around with the other day, you know, on Notebook LM, you can create a PowerPoint, a podcast, a recorded lecture, infographics, flashcards, more and more and more, mind maps in about 3 minutes.
That's right.
So I'm just really starting to expand my mind into, well, what do I want to spend my time doing? I don't love research. I do it, but I don't love it.
Yeah.
I love studying and writing about Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. So is this going to open up a big gap for me to start publishing in that area? Because I love to do anyway.
Yeah, and it'll give you tools to research that faster. Right. To help you kind of create products for that. If we look at it like it opens up my space for creativity. Yeah, you could automate a lot of your tasks. Right. And spend more time on that area that you love. And then you could also expand what you're creating within that area, whether it's products and papers and presentations. So I do. I think we need to look at it as because people also say we didn't talk about this where it's making us, how do I say this politely, not as smart or, you know, we're not using all our cognitive abilities now. And there's some early studies that people are pointing to. But maybe it's opening up other areas of the brain and other areas we can strengthen, like our creativity and just our problem solving and all that. So it can make room for us to do other things that in the past we didn't have the time to do. We didn't have the tools, the resources.
I completely agree. So I think you've written a book recently. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes, the book we're actually just finishing through the editing process. So it's going to publish on April 7th, this April. Wow. April 7th, they can pre-order it, but it's going to officially publish on April 7th. It's called Meta Meditation, M-E-T-A Meditation, How Neuroscience, Virtual Reality, and AI Are Changing Practice and How You Can Benefit. And the book came about was I was starting to write a book on, I think, just kind of updating the neuroscience of mindfulness meditation. And the more I researched the book, I started to see this trend of, wait a minute, meditation is not the thing that I learned. You know, it is, the essence of it is, but the way that people are becoming exposed and accessible and learning, there's a whole phenomenon going on here. And I didn't really see anybody writing about it. There wasn't necessarily really a lot of books or any books on this phenomenon. And I called it meta meditation, meaning beyond meditation, or something like meditation, but now it's morphed. It's evolved into something else because the neuroscience gives us, we can look under the hood, so to speak, in the brain. We know exactly, or mostly, what's going on. We know what's going on in the physiology of the body, which we never knew before. We could use that data to hone in our meditation, to improve our instruction. Then there was the virtual reality component, where it's creating these virtual or 3D settings to learn meditation. And then I said, wow, the AI is coming in, and it's further personalizing. So when I put those like forces, when I see those forces coming together, I said, this is a whole new thing. You know, meditation is sitting there, meditation, but everything around it is really changed and accelerated and evolving. So I said, the second part of it is I go, well, how do we make use of that? Like, how do we use that if we're new to meditation or say, like us, we're existing yoga meditation practice for a long time. How do we incorporate that or make sense or navigate all these fast moving parts? So that's why I wrote the book to help people and say, look, there is a phenomenon going on, but how do you take advantage of it? How do you make it work for you?
I love it. I can't wait to read your book.
Thanks.
You know, the hard part is everything's moving so fast. You're going to put it out by April. You might need to update it by the following April, right?
Yes. That's what I tell publishers. And even when I'm proposing a book now, I go, how fast can we do it? And it's still like a year and a half to get the book out. And I kind of joke. I'm like, by that time, the AI information is going to need to be updated.
Do you have a Substack or anything that you publish so people could keep up in real
time? I have not. I've been looking into Substack. It sounds like I should do something like that on the AI mindfulness,
Fun
yeah, so that they
fact.
could keep up. So I'm going to look into that. No, I'm regular on some social like LinkedIn and share a lot on there, some of the concepts and ideas around AI mindfulness, but I'll have to look into the subset.
And we also look forward to seeing your research with your college students and hearing how they felt about MetaZen.
Meta Zen, yeah, same as the book, META, like the book, and then Zen. Yeah, so we have that one. And then there's another study that we've launched where we're looking at mindfulness, the construct of mindfulness, in other words, how mindful or present moment awareness you have in relationship to AI concerns and fears among undergraduates. So they're already in these yoga and mindfulness classes where their mindfulness probably getting pretty high based on one study that came out of China. There seems to be some correlation between if your mindfulness is increased, that can help you with your AI concerns and fears and see it more as a positive creative tool. So we're looking at that study. And then there's one more we're just getting through the IRB on, but I'm excited about this. I think you'll like this. So I thought, why don't we interview expert meditation teachers around the country and just ask them, are you using AI in your practice? If not, how can we create an ethical model that maintains the essence, the purity, the essence of it, but still maybe use AI as an extension? Hence, I've got a grad student team, and we're going to talk to as many meditation experts as we can.
Come to our department at Notre Dame of Maryland because we have about 40 people studying a 2-year master's program in the area of, yoga, meditation. So
Oh, yep. Maybe we can do something with that. Yeah.
get our students to fill out your questionnaires. That would be great.
Yeah, I'll think about that. Yeah. On this one with the meditation teachers, we hope we have a framework. They call this kind of study, for people that are not familiar with research, it's grounded theory study. We hope by talking to enough experts from the ground up, we can take this data and create a framework, conceptual framework, really, that can guide future instructional practice and curriculum. So other teachers could take this and say, oh, okay, these are the main elements, and this might be a pathway for us to keep the essence, the true purpose and nature of our meditation practice or tradition, but maybe add these AI elements in.
Amazing. Well, Steve, I think by the time this airs, we will put your contact information, some landing pages for your book, maybe a website or two. We'll put those in the show notes so that if people want to get in touch and see more of your work, they can find it in the show notes.
That's great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for being with us today. I think we showed a lot of different ways that AI can benefit humanity, such as expanding access and helping more people to get introduced to breath awareness, to regulation skills, to reflective practices. People that would never seek out a yoga therapist or a meditation teacher are now going to start to understand what these contemplative tools can do, and they may transfer into having a relationship with a real human. So that is kind of exciting. And also, as Steve said, it can provide support between sessions. So that's kind of how, when we developed our app, it's not an AI app, but the Optimal State app, we were thinking of it as the support between sessions where people could kind of track the state of their gunas or their nervous system, if you will, and kind of look at their own data to learn which directions they're getting out of balance and how to come back into balance. So that gap that Steve talked about and providing that support between sessions for yourself and your clients as a kind of a personalized check-in tool, a reminder to check in and a reminder to breathe. That's a big thing. And then also on our app, we do data tracking and kind of showing the person. We don't know who you are because, like I said, you can use any email that you want, but your data is contained within your little pod of the app, and you can kind of look at your own data patterning and see what times of the year, what times of the day, what times of the week you tend to get a little bit out of balance and not feeling so well. And so those are some of the real positives. When we look at the risks associated, basically some of what we do will be outsourced, right? The commodification of the contemplative practice. And there's a real risk there. that the apps or the AI will be able to do some of the things that you are doing as a yoga teacher, meditation teacher. It may be a little bit more transactional, that it may be just based on data instead of human heart connection. But for some people, as we've stated, maybe they're not comfortable having a heart-to-heart relationship with a human. Again, it may be a starting point for them to try to start to build some inner balance and inner resistance. Let's face it, these apps are a little bit less expensive than going to a teacher for most people, so that could be a good thing. Some of the other things we really need to keep in mind, and this is where Steve said it's got to be human-centered. There needs to be someone kind of tracking how things are going and checking in. Obviously, the app isn't empathetic to you. It cannot co-regulate with you. So the client or the student may have false attunement. They think they're getting empathy. They think somehow they're co-regulating, but really it's a large language model. It's just putting words together. What's the next most likely word that should go here? And sometimes it does a good job figuring out what the next most likely word should be, and sometimes it does a terrible job. So, remembering that it's only through human connection that we can get true empathy and true co-regulation. So those of you out there that are wondering if you're going to be outsourced, that's your sweet spot. That's where you need to go. You're going to have something that AI cannot offer. All right, a couple more things we need to be careful about is scope of practice confusion. We're going to start to see this melding of psychotherapy, clinical intervention, mindfulness, chatbots, and we have to really get clear that we're not going out of scope of practice. And I think that's a real thing right now. We've got these large language models, which were not developed for therapy, literally giving therapy. So there's already been some breaks that are starting to show up and, putting the brakes on to try to refine that, but that's really what's happening. So I think in summary, the deeper issue is not if AI will replace yoga teachers, yoga therapists, meditation teachers. It's whether, we can find our sweet spot, our skill base, the clinical discernment, the embodiment, the ethics, the co-regulation, the empathy, the ability to sit with someone in silence and hold them and be with them. And to kind of track these subtle shifts in their nervous system and adjust in real time. So there is plenty for us to do, and it may look different than we had imagined 5 years ago. All right. Thank you, everybody, for this great time together. We look forward to speaking with you next week, and have a great one. Thank you, Steve.
A way that you can help support the Yoga Therapy Hour. Our Optimal State mobile app is available for both Android and iPhone. We've really simplified the check-in process, and it's a way to track your nervous system regulation as well as your physical health and mental health. It can be part of your personal or professional practice. And by that, what we mean is that you might like to track your own nervous system, mental and physical health, and see the data for yourself, as well as receive interventions, do yoga nidras, breath work, meditation. All of it is on the app, and new content is being added all the time. But a second way you might like to use it is to recommend that your clients, your students, also use the app so that they can show you the data about their nervous system, about their mental and physical health. You can see where they've been in the weeks or months between the times that you meet with them as a practitioner. The app offers structured practices, self-assessment tools, and it's guided and rooted in yoga therapy and nervous system science. It's designed to help you track your state and begin to understand what shifts you and how to choose practices that will bring you back into balance. Whether you're using it for your own well-being or integrating it into the care for others that you offer, we'd love for you to come check it out and do the 3-week free trial. After that, it's about $5 a month. It's a tool that can support you and also the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Thanks for listening to this small way that you can support the Yoga Therapy Hour.
We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.